Rent.com. From The Cooperage Project in Homesdale, thecooperageproject.org. And from listeners like you.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatscale. I'm Patricio Robile, filling in for Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Reporters Roundtable returns. I check in with journalist Liam Mayo of The River Reporter, Chris Raleigh with the Shorongok Journal, and Derek Kirk from the Sullivan County Democrat about the latest news and issues facing our listening area. Stroke Awareness Month, the month of May, is Stroke Awareness Month. We will speak to the Chief Emergency Room Doctor for Wayne Memorial Hospital, Dr. Stanley Swirsky, to let us know what are the signs of a stroke and ways to prevent them. And finally, I sit down virtually with Rebecca Rivera, the editor of the Spanish language newspaper for Sullivan County, Hoy en Sullivan. She'll let us know what's in the latest issue and talk about the matters facing the Hispanic community. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he still expects extensive fighting with Russian forces in the days ahead, but he believes the conflict will ultimately be resolved diplomatically. NPR's Greg Myrie reports the president spoke in a TV interview alongside his wife, a rare joint appearance by the couple.
President Zelensky compared the war in Ukraine to a hybrid car with dual power sources. The war, he says, will be driven by both combat and by negotiations. He said, quote, "Victory will be very difficult. It will be bloody. It will definitely be a battle. But the ending will definitely be through diplomacy. I'm sure of it." Periodic negotiations were not making progress, and Ukraine and Russia both announced this past week that all talks were suspended. Zelensky spoke while seated next to his wife, Olena, who has made few public appearances during the war and only rarely with her husband. Greg Myrie, NPR News. Kyiv.
A federal judge has blocked the Biden administration from lifting the pandemic border restrictions known as Title 42. NPR's Joel Rose reports that public health order had been set to end on Monday.
The ruling is a victory for the Republican-led states pushing to extend the restrictions. Title 42 allows immigration authorities to quickly expel migrants at the border, sharply limiting how many can seek asylum. The CDC says it's no longer needed to protect public health. But more than 20 states signed on to a lawsuit brought by Arizona, Missouri, and Louisiana. They argued that the CDC did not go through the proper procedures to end Title 42 and should have considered the impact on state health care systems and other costs of a potential influx of migrants. A federal judge in Louisiana granted the preliminary injunction those states had been seeking, meaning that Title 42 could be in place for a long time to come. Joel Rose, NPR News.
The Justice Department says it will appeal. The World Health Organization says that a rare outbreak of monkeypox has spread to 11 countries, including Canada and the U.S. People typically catch monkeypox from a rodent and the virus, but generally it doesn't spread easily between people and occurs only in West and Central Africa. Epidemiologist Anne Ramoyne at the University of California, Los Angeles, says in this new outbreak, scientists don't know how it's spreading.
How exactly is this being transmitted? Is this close contact? Is this sexual transmission? Is it because of a contact with a product that potentially has been contaminated with monkeypox?
There are now 130 suspected cases worldwide. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has conceded defeat in a national election today. In a televised speech in Sydney, he said that while vote counting was incomplete, the opposition Labour Party looked likely to form a government. This is NPR.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Liam Mayo from The River Reporter. On Friday, May 20, Dr. Jonathan Servus released final drafts for New York State's Senate and congressional redistricting maps. Servus was brought in as a special master to redraw the state's districts after legal challenges to redistricting maps approved in February. Under the new maps, Sullivan County remains in the 19th congressional district, but moves to the 51st state Senate district, and will no longer be in the 42nd. Senator Mike Martucci has declared his intent to run for the 42nd district, which comprises his home of Orange County. School districts across Sullivan County held their school board elections on May 17. In Sullivan West, five individuals were running for three seats on the board. Rose Joyce Turner ran unopposed. Jackie Rutledge beat out Kristen Johnson in a head-to-head race, and Michael Elmauer did the same to Craig Passante. In addition, the Board of Education has chosen Dr. Kathleen Bressler as the district's next superintendent of schools. Bressler has served as interim superintendent since January. And the town of Highland passed a number of resolutions at its May 10 town board meeting. The town partnered with Camp Coninha to provide a six-week full-day day camp for Highland children aged 5 through 12, set a $500 annual permitting fee for short-term rentals, and entered into a lease agreement with Pex Markets for the placement of plantings from Eagle Park. The board has tabled a proposed ATV law. This news roundup is produced in partnership with the River Reporter. I'm Liam Mayo.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Patricia Robayo sitting in for Tim Bruno. The Reporters Roundtable is back, and this month I sat down virtually with three reporters from our listening area. We talked about the latest in the county's redistricting efforts and how it will affect us come Election Day. And we also get an update on the Delaware Aqueduct shutdown. We also be discussing if Tunstall Town Hall will be moving. Here's the Reporters Roundtable for the month of May. Welcome to another edition of the Reporters Roundtable. Joining me today are journalists Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Raleigh with the Shawangunk Journal, and Derek Kirk from the Sullivan County Democrat. Before we get to our roundtable, just to let you know, the Reporters Roundtable is now a podcast. Search WJFF, the Reporters Roundtable, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. It's been quite a busy month, so let's get straight to it. Now, Liam, the Sullivan County Legislature has been talking about redistricting. Could you provide some updates on the process and sort of give us a general overview of what is happening?
Yeah, so the legislature has hired a company to do their redistricting. They're having to, it's a separate process from the statewide redistricting. And what it is they're having to change around the districts that elect each of the nine legislators to the Sullivan County Legislature. And they've elected to bring in this company called Main Street Communications to do their redistricting. Main Street Communications has, according to legislators, done redistricting each of the previous two cycles. I believe it happens once every 10 years or so. It's tied to the census and tied to shifts in population. It's also a Democratic media firm that boasts a pretty strong record of success with Democratic candidates across the country. So it's got this wing that's a Democratic media firm, and it's got this wing that's a very independent redistricting company. And they had a meeting with Dave Heller, who's the sort of one-man band behind Main Street Communications and its redistricting arm. They met with him on May 12 to discuss sort of what his contribution to the cycle would be. And he pretty much described his role in the process as he's a computer. I think were his words. He takes whatever data the legislators think is appropriate and then draws the lines accordingly. He said that the normal default data that he would draw from is just the census data about populations and the makeup of those populations. He also offered that legislators provide him with voter info, so like where people have voted and who they voted for, and legislators opted not really to do that. And they also opted for a pretty hands-off redistricting process. Rather than having individual legislators speak with Dave Heller throughout the process, everything's going to go through County Manager Josh Potosik. So it's very much just they're leaving Dave Heller to do his thing, and that thing will, by June 18, result in a set of three maps, I believe is the plan. And those maps will go out to just the county at large. It'll go out to legislators. It'll go out to just the general public. And the idea behind that is so that everyone has enough time to see those maps and respond to those maps before they get voted into any sort of action. Supposedly in previous rounds of redistricting, it was only sort of a small committee that saw the different possibilities of maps. And then they decided between themselves which map to work with. And that was the only map put out to the public. So Legislative Chair Rob Daugherty is being very forthright with his intent to have this be a very open and transparent process where everyone gets to see the different options on the table, everyone gets to respond to them, and hopefully by the time the process concludes, we'll have maps that everyone is happy with. Although that seems like a pretty good case of wishful thinking.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see once the results have come out and to see the reaction towards it, because what I've seen lately coming out of the kind of legislature meetings is sometimes a tumultuous discord between the members of the public and the board.
Yeah, the tumultuous things at the Sullivan County Legislature. I've already heard slight rumors of that from the meetings, with people being suspicious about how transparent this process has been. It's like, if you are continually saying you're not trying to hide anything, what are you trying to hide? I was just going to mention that so far the process seems to be going pretty smoothly, but I would also allude to the current statewide redistricting, which I believe we'll hear a little bit more about later from Derek, and just say that redistricting in general draws a lot of strong emotions.
Right.
I would not be surprised if those come out a little later on in this process.
There's a story that we've been following on the Local Edition, you've been talking about on the Local Edition, and you mentioned also here previously on the Reporters Roundtable about the Delaware Aqueduct closing to do major repairs. This is a major vital water supply for New York City and the region. What can you tell us about the latest on that project?
Yeah. So the Delaware Aqueduct, as you said, it supplies New York City with its water. It draws water away from the four reservoirs up in the head of the Delaware River, down to New York City. It draws about 500 to 600 million gallons a day from those reservoirs, which is about half of New York City's drinking water. And a lot of local residents' concerns revolve around the upcoming closure of that aqueduct. Starting in October, the aqueduct's going to close for around 5 to 8 months for repairs. And those 500 to 600 million gallons of water a day aren't going to be leaving the reservoirs in the upper Delaware. So residents are concerned that there will be flooding along the Delaware River as those reservoirs fill up. There are sort of two areas that people are looking at as potential concerns. Department of Environmental Protection, which is sort of the linchpin of this whole Delaware Aqueduct effort, will be releasing a lot of water from the reservoirs prior to the shutdown to try and get levels down pretty low. So the river will be fairly high throughout the summer leading into the fall because of these maximum releases. So people are somewhat concerned about flooding there, but they're a little more concerned about flooding on the other end of it, where depending on how long the shutdown goes, we could be fairly late into 2023 and the reservoirs could be filling up with just time and with rains, and that water might not have anywhere to go, and it could potentially spill out over the top of the reservoirs and lead to some flooding along the river.
Has there been any talk about the potential negative environmental impact from the work that's going to be done at the aqueduct during this time frame?
I don't believe there have been any concerns about the environmental impact of them. There are some concerns about wetlands in Roseton, one of the places where, I believe it's Roseton. Well, there are two places where the aqueduct is leaking in Wolvorsing and in Roseton near Newburgh. And I believe in the Roseton area, some of the leaking water is contributing to wetlands in the area. So there's concern about if you shut off the leaks, you might lose some of those wetlands.
Right.
Other than that, I haven't really heard about environmental impacts from the process because the aqueduct will be shut down. There won't be really water flowing through the area of the repairs to carry any kind of contaminants into New York City's drinking water supply. And I have to imagine they're going to do their homework and make sure that everything is cleared out of those tunnels and everything is perfectly safe before opening the floodgates back up.
Yeah, literally opening the floodgates. It's funny they use that word because we always hear that word everywhere. In this particular instance, there actually are floodgates.
Yeah, opening the sort of metaphorical and literal floodgates. Yeah. But then another thing that's just sort of important to mention is the DEP is putting a lot of faith in their forecasting models for doing this shutdown. They've said on a number of occasions that if the weather isn't looking conducive to the shutdown, they will push it back a year. So they would do that if the weather's looking too dry and there are worries about New York City not having enough water. But they also said that they would do that if the weather was looking too wet and there would be major concerns about flooding on the Upper Delaware. So I think they're confident that there won't be any major issues from going into the shutdown. And I think local residents are just trying to keep an eye on them and trying to make sure that their confidence is warranted.
Definitely something to keep an eye on, and I'm sure you keep us informed on the local edition or here on the Reporters Roundtable. Now, Derek, the redistricting, it seems like I said before, it seems like the hot topic, the hot word for this election season. It seems like the news is changing every day. What can you tell us about what's going on at the state Senate level with redistricting?
I've been following more so in the recent article I've been writing about the Senate district changing. And I've been looking at Senator Mike Martucci and what all that is going on. And it would appear to be that we are joining the 51st Senate district, and that would encompass a great deal of Ulster, Delaware, Green, excuse me if I can't pronounce this right, Shaughnessy, Otsego, Chenango, and Broome counties. So it's a massive Senate district in the newest maps put out by.
So in this new district, that means we're no longer in the 42nd district. So that means we are no longer have State Senator Martucci as our representative.
Yes. Recently, Mike Martucci announced his campaign to run in Orange County. So it is definite that Sullivan County will be losing Senator Mike Martucci as a representative because of moving into the 51st. It appears to be that we will be taking on a new senator, Peter Oberacker. Speaking with him, it appears he is close with Martucci. They know each other. They have been in communication. So Oberacker appears to be familiar with Sullivan County's issues and specifically the opioid epidemic that Sullivan County is dealing with. Time will tell if Senator Oberacker will be able to pick up where Martucci left off and continue that specific campaign against opioid crisis in Sullivan County.
Do you know if he's running unopposed as of now?
He is not run opposed. I believe right now he is running against Eric Ball, the Democratic nominee on the other side.
Now, another area you cover is Tungsten. You cover the Tungsten town board. Now, the last Liam brought this up to our attention on the local edition about Tungsten moving their town hall from next to the theater on Bridge Street all the way to Main Street in Narrowsburg. Main Street, Narrowsburg. Is that move still happening? What can you tell us about the latest on that controversial move?
The town of Tustin bought 93 Main Street last summer for about $1,400,000. And I was speaking with Supervisor Johnson. When they initially bought the property, he told the Democrat that he was excited to gain more office space. So according to him, that was one of the biggest reasons that this question was even happening, because it would appear that a vast majority of those who spoke during public comment and are very passionate about this topic very, very much want Town Hall to remain at 210 Bridge Street beneath the theater. As per last town board meeting, it would appear that there are talks about renting out 93 Main Street. And I believe that they will be doing research into how that process will go about. I don't believe that there are any commitments to renting out quite yet, but it would appear that that is the direction the town is taking. they appear to be remaining in 210 Bridge Street for now. And it also includes the parking lot behind the bank, which eliminated the possibility of simply selling the property, as the town would like to retain the parking lot. And according to the town board, it would be very, very difficult or near impossible to sell the division of the parking lot and the building. So naturally, that option is taken off the table.
Now, Chris, let's look what's happening at Ellaville and Ulster County. Housing has been an issue across the country and also right here in our listening area. Chris, what can you tell us about what's the housing situation in Ellaville?
Yeah, no, this week I did a piece based on the Benjamin Center's report. Let me just get you the name of it, because it sort of tells you everything. The Benjamin Center study was called Adding to the Load: How Built-in Biases in Assessment Make the Property Tax Even More Regressive in Ulster County. And there's quite a lot of information to go with this. The article can go 2,000 words. I'm so glad I'm not an editor. But, you know, there was a lot to get in there. The basics of it are that the bigger the property, the more horse barns and swimming pools you have and everything, the more likely you are to be underassessed. Whereas if you just have your 3-4 bedroom stick built on 2 to 4 acres, you're going to be assessed much more tightly and much more accurately. It just seems to be another of these inbuilt advantages for wealthy people in the United States. You know, file this one alongside, you know, the carried interest loophole. How to pay as little tax as possible. You know, I mean, if you've got the money to set up companies and do that kind of, you know, jiggery pokery with your money, then you can pay taxes of 15% or less. You know, it just gets on and on and on. Anyway, this report had a number of interesting things about it, and it seems maybe it will start a conversation. However, I'll just read you something, because as doing this, I did some background. And a lot of this comes back to decision by New York State Court of Appeals in 1975, the Hellerstein decision, which called for assessments to be made in the state at full value. That means the full value of any property should be what the assessment would be. When that came down to the legislature, they leapt out of their seats, because, as the Benjamin Center report noted, the widespread revaluation of properties across the state that would have been required to implement this decision almost certainly would have resulted in a significant shift in property tax liability from businesses and newer residents to long-established homeowners and voters. To avoid a political earthquake, the legislature blocked implementation of the decision for 6 years, and then, overriding the governor's veto, repealed Senate Bill 306 of the Real Property Tax Law and substituted 305.2, which explicitly permits assessment at a uniform percentage of value. And I suggest that everybody try to find out what in what township they are, what the uniform percentage of value is that your property taxes are based on. And it wants to be as close to 100% as possible. It's allowed usually to drift away from that. And before there was a reval in Wawarsing a few years ago, it had to be down in the 0.065% range, which shows you how crazy it was, you know. So anyway, that reval in 2016 caused a lot of anger, a lot of ructions, because people suddenly discovered they were going to be taxed, and they hadn't been for generations, you know. So anyway, so I did that this week, and it was a deep patrol through the weeds of property tax. And I suggest everybody, if they can, take a look at it on News Atomic, or if you can pick up a copy of the Shangoma Journal, you've got it in print. Beyond that, a little piece of thing we should note is that the Cresco Labs IDA application for a pilot that was approved last night. So That's happened. So as far as I can see, everything is cleared out of the way for Cresco Labs to come in and set up their $209 million, 380,000 square foot growing and processing facility for cannabis in Warsaw.
Right. This is a project you've been following a lot on here on the Local Edition, also on the Reporters Roundtable. So we look forward to hearing more stories on this processing plant and see if those projections that they gave on full-time positions and a boost in the local economy, if it actually does happen. Now, we've been talking off air about this particular sculpture that is moving from Thompsonville to Ellenville, or has moved already from Thompsonville to Ellenville. And now it's the sculpture that lived at a defunct Borscht Belt resort. And now, like you said, it's could make its way to Ellenville. What can you tell us about this sculpture that was in Thompson, now is going to Ellenville?
Yes, and we would love to, if anybody knows anything about this sculpture, we would love to find out more about it. It was set up originally, it's 15 feet tall. It has a look to it, sort of Star Trek, sort of late 50s, outer space kind of abstraction. It's in cement with rebar. Flowing lines, hands or arms reaching up to the stars. Who can say? Anyway, it was placed outside Schenck's Paramount Hotel in the mid-60s and flourished there for quite a while, along with everything else. The Schenck's was a really typical big Borscht Belt hotel with a huge swimming pool and sort of 20th century modern buildings, including the iconic round card room, which was behind this sculpture. Anyway, Schenck's closed and was sold to Bobov Hasidim, who turned it into what's it called? Chavas Summer Camp. And they took down the 20th century modern wings, but they left the card room for a while and attached other kind of structures to it. And then recently they decided that the card room itself had to come down, and that put the statue at risk. And by that time, it was kind of surrounded by brush and small trees, and it sort of disappeared from view. However, this young lady, a youngish lady, Marisa Scheinfeld, who is a professor of photography at SUNY Purchase, she had been notified. She had noticed this thing all her life because she was like, for instance, she was she told me today, she was a lifeguard at the Concorde, and she drove past this thing every day, but she never really took any notice of it. But now in 2011, she had taken notice because she took pictures of these things for her book, The Borscht Belt, which I believe is on Cornell Press. In 2016. Anyway, she was alerted, and various people, Andrew Jacobs, other people got into action on this, and they rented a flatbed truck with a crane, and somehow or other they got this thing out of the ground. It is massive. Its base is a good cubic yard or 2 cubic yards of cement and rocks. They got it out, put it on a flatbed, brought it to Ellenville, all wrapped in blankets and stuff. And it's sitting there waiting to be trimmed at the base and then re-erected in front of Barbara Hoff's Top Shelf Jewelry, which is the former Ellenville Railroad Station. This is going to be an interesting little monument to the Borscht Belt. Now, eventually, they hope to have a little museum somewhere dedicated to the Borscht Belt stuff. And this megalith can go to that, you know, and carry on. It will need to be cleaned up, given a coat of paint, but it will be another intriguing thing beside the road where people come into Ellenville. It will be. I can just see people going, what was that? Hey, Harry, turn around, go back. You know, I can just see that coming.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it would be a worthwhile effort just to go back to the old news clippings to see if maybe there was a press release on it when the thing was erected. If you know, like, when sort of the general timeline on it. Now, you're saying as of now, there's no plaques on it, there's no signature on the base or anything like that that would sort of indicate who the artist is?
Well, nothing at this point. And I can assure you that Marisa has really searched hard on the internet. And I searched a little bit. Yeah. None of the tricks that I use has shown up anything more than Schenck's Hotel existed. We do know that the Schenck's bought it from the Miller family. Mm. And it's actually in Thompson, not in Fallsburg. It's often misidentified geographically as being in Fallsburg. It's not. It's actually in Thompson. And it belongs to the Bobov these days, and they don't have any interest in it. So it's gone. But, yeah, we would love to know who the sculptor was, and what the story is behind it. You know, it would be a great little tale. So we hope. We'll put it out there and see what comes in.
We're definitely interested to find who the artist is and the story behind it. I've seen some pictures of it online since the story sort of has been circulating around. And it's very modern looking, very, very, you know, modern looking, spacey type of structure.
Yeah, the style is definitely a sort of subsector of mid-century modern. And I've seen that graphic style was seen a lot on science fiction paperback covers in the late 50s. I mean, I have a number of them. there was a certain kind of set of things. And you can see it definitely shows up again, that style, in Star Trek. I mean, there's a lot about that stuff that Gene Roddenberry, put into Star Trek that evinces this particular style of design, you know.
We'll see. Anyway. It's definitely a story that I would love to keep a track on. And definitely let us know in the future, either on the local edition or here on the Reporters Roundtable, what you found out. This has been the Reporters Roundtable. I've been your host, Patricio Robayo. We're joined today by journalist Leah Mayo of The River Reporter, Chris Riley with the Shonkong Journal, and Derek Kirk from the Sullivan County Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us for the Reporters Roundtable. Don't forget, the Reporters Roundtable is a podcast. Search for WJFF, the Reporters Roundtable, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast to find out past shows. Thank you, take care, and see you next month. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, it's Stroke Awareness Month. Do you know the signs of a stroke? Do you know how to prevent them? We'll be talking to the Chief Emergency Room Doctor for Wayne Memorial. We'll be right back. This is Radio Chatskill.
The racist shooting at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York, has brought new focus to the threat of white nationalism. How activists are fighting this threat, Monday afternoon on All Things Considered.
I'm Scott Simon. What's that old saying, make lemonade out of lemons? How about making your favorite shows out of your old lemon? I know, it's a stretch, but you can donate your car to support this station. Here's how.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricia Robayo. May is Stroke Awareness Month. Do you know the signs of a stroke? Do you know how to prevent them? On the phone with us now is the Chief Emergency Doctor, Stanley Stuwinski, from Wayne Memorial, to talk to us about Stroke Awareness Month. Doctor, welcome to the program. Can we first start off by telling us what exactly is the difference between a stroke and a heart attack?
Yeah, they're sort of the same pathology, the same problem, but the heart attack, of course, affects the heart and the stroke attacks the brain. But they're both they both occur because of some type of blockage in one of the arteries that feed the heart and or the brain. So when you have a blocked artery in the heart, you have a heart attack downstream. And when you have a blocked artery in the brain, you have a stroke downstream from where that blockage is. So it's the same mechanism, different body parts.
And now what are sort of the telltale signs if a person who thinks they're having a stroke or sees someone who thinks they might be having a stroke? What are some of the telltale signs that we should be looking out for?
Well, the acronym we use is called FAST, F-A-S-T, F stands for facial drooping. So if you look at somebody and their face is drooping or crooked, that's one of the signs. Arm weakness, which could also be any limb weakness, arm or leg, but generally they can't move it or it feels clumsy. And then we talk about speech difficulty. The S is for speech difficulty. You could have trouble just speaking. You're dysarthric, meaning that, you know, you're having trouble pronouncing the words because your mouth muscles are being affected by a stroke. And then you could also have the part of the brain that controls the communication is not working right. So you have trouble saying what you want to. You might know what you want to say, but you can't say it, or it comes out different. And then the T stands for time to call 911. So those are the main things that we try to, you know, teach the public and laypersons, and even the EMTs use this type of protocol as well, just to get an idea if it's a possibility of a stroke. So there are many things that mimic strokes, and that's our job to sort of determine that. But if you have any of those symptoms, you need to get to the ER.
Right, definitely. Is it, and, you know, I guess some people sort of associate, I associated in the past sort of pain with stroke, but I recently was talking to someone who had a stroke and they weren't feeling any pain. And the only reason they found out I had a stroke was because they were in the hospital and the nurse came up to them and said, something's wrong with your speech. And he just couldn't say anything. He just was trying to say something, but he just couldn't. And then he found out he was stroking. I asked him afterwards, did you feel any pain? He goes, no, I didn't feel anything.
There are hemorrhagic strokes, which is bleeding in the brain from an aneurysm or something like that. And those cause severe headaches. So that, you know, some people come in with stroke symptoms and usually the people with the big bleeds in their brain are a lot of times they're unresponsive or they're really, really sick. And, then we do the CAT scans on them. You see the blood in the brain, and those are treated much differently than a stroke that's caused by a blockage of an artery.
When someone has a stroke that affects the brain, how exactly is that treated?
Well, it depends on the cause of it. What we do first, we do a CAT scan on the brain to see if there's anything else there. Is there bleeding? Is there a tumor? And if there's not, and we go right to a CAT scan of the neck and the head with IV dye, and we see if there's a blockage somewhere along the blood vessels that go to the brain. If we see a blockage and there's no contraindications, then we give clot busting medicine called TPA. And, that medicine goes in and breaks down blood clots in your body. And it helps to dissolve that clot. So once the clot dissolves, the blood gets to the brain and the oxygen gets to the brain, the brain's downstream, and you could stop the stroke completely. You could partially stop it. Again, it depends on the time frame. People that get here earlier are more likely to do better because there's less brain damage done downstream from the blockage. There are people that don't meet the time requirements to give this clot busting medications. They have been pushing it out farther and farther. When we first started using TPA, we had a 3-hour time limit. Now it's like a 4.5, 6-hour time limit, and they keep stretching it. Other people have significant blockages that we sometimes can send to a tertiary center like Geisinger, and they will have their neurologists, neurosurgeons, and interventional radiologist, and they'll go in and open up those blockages. Sometimes they take the clot that's in that blood vessel out. They suck it out through the catheters that go up into the arteries of the brain. So it's very high tech, but there's a lot of that gets done quite regularly. So those are the two main treatment protocols. One is the TPA. Two is to go in and do something interventionally, surgically. So
wow, that could be sounds scary, but it could be a little overwhelming for some people. So hearing that, what can we do to sort of prevent us from having a stroke?
Well, there's a lot of things. Blood pressure control, over time untreated the hypertension just damages the blood vessels and then they're prone to have strokes. Atrial fibrillation is another one that's a very common cause of a stroke. some people go in and out of atrial fibrillation and they don't even know it. And the first presentation or the first time we find that they have AFib is when they come in having stroke symptoms. Smoking, big problem. Just destroys your blood vessels. Alcohol sort of goes along with this smoking habit. The cholesterol, supposedly, you know, controlling your cholesterol and keeping your cholesterol controlled and the right types of cholesterol will decrease the amount of plaque buildup. Diabetes, again, you know, most people don't know that diabetes is a vascular disease. It's your sugar, but the damage that the elevated sugars do on your system is to the blood vessels. It destroys blood vessels. That's why diabetics go blind and have kidney failure and heart attacks and strokes. So controlling your diabetes is very big. And just being healthy, you know, exercising, eating the right diet and stuff like that, are the main things that you can do something about.
You know, the pandemic was here. A lot of people avoided going to the hospital, thinking they were going to get COVID or anything like that. And a lot of people missed appointments, things like that. Have you seen, as an ER doctor, have you seen sort of an increase or decrease in strokes over the past 2 years?
Initially, when the pandemic started, you know, we didn't see anybody with heart attacks or strokes. I don't know where they went, but they didn't come to the ER. And then they started to pick up. And then, you know, I can't say that it's any worse than it was before the pandemic, but The one thing that we have been seeing a large number of patients is people with cancer. We're seeing people come in and their presentation for their cancer, they're already terminal. They're already stage four metastatic. And it's because nobody went to their family doctors and got their routine screening things done, tests done in the last 2 years. So, you know, that little pain in their side that hasn't gone away in the last 8 months now, that might have been a kidney tumor. Now it's spread to the liver and the lungs and the brain. And like I said, you know, we diagnosed them and they're already sort of terminal or stage four when they walk in the door. So.
Wow. That's scary to hear. And definitely if those who haven't gotten their routine checks, please do so right away, because that's a scary thing. Just 2 years, how much bad things could happen. So. Like I said, May is Stroke Awareness Month, and Doctor, you gave us a lot of good information as far as preventing strokes and, you know, preventing this for damage to yourself. Is there anything we have not touched on that you want our listeners to know about May being Stroke Awareness Month?
Yeah, just that Wayne Memorial Hospital is a certified primary stroke center. We're affiliated with Geisinger Medical Center. We have very strict protocols that we follow. If people come in by ambulance, shorter stroke symptoms, we call a stroke alert before they even get here. The physician meets the patient at the ambulance door. So they get off the ambulance, they're met by the team, and the physicians evaluate the patient. They go right to CAT scan. If there's no signs of bleeding or tumors under CAT scan, we do a CAT scan with dye to look at the arteries. And then the patients come into the ER. As soon as we evaluate them and they go to CAT scan, we are affiliated with Geisinger. We call this the stroke neurologist or somebody on 24/7. And we talk to the stroke neurologist and we send the CAT scans to a cloud system. And the stroke neurologist and myself will look at the CAT scan in real time at the same time, discuss it, see what we see. And then we'll come up with a plan. If there's no contraindications for them to receive the blood clot busting medication, we'll order it as quickly as we can. We're trying to get down to like 45 minute door to TPA time frame. You know, if there's something that if they're not a candidate for TPA and they're a candidate for something invasive, then we get them transferred down to Geisinger as soon as possible, often by helicopter. And they'll go right to the OR there sometimes with this, neurosurgeons, and they'll go in and retrieve a clot or stent a blockage or something like that. So the protocol we use is pretty tight, and well rehearsed. And, I think we do it very well. We've had some amazing stroke saves in the last 2 years. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. The technology is there, and we're pushing the envelope, and it's changing every day. They now have CAT scans. They have these protocols that could almost read the CAT scans themselves, and they warn you if there's something here or there going on. So, we're getting a new scanner like that very shortly. So it's we're moving forward, and we're saving a lot of people's lives and saving them from the tremendous disability a lot of times. So it's an exciting time to be a doctor.
Yeah, no, definitely. That sounds fantastic that technology is advancing that much that, you know, so the system could tell you that.
They're just calling a stroke alert overhead right now in our place here.
Oh, wow. All right, so you definitely have to go. So thank you, Dr. Stanley, for letting us know about this information. Let us know about Stroke Awareness Month, what it takes to be aware of it, and what it takes to prevent it. So thank you so much for talking to us. Let us know about this very important issue.
All right. Thank you, sir.
We'll be right back after a short break with the editor of Oy & Sullivan. This is Radio Chatskill.
Join me, Staff Sergeant Doug Sandberg, for a special Memorial Day edition of Let's Talk Vets. We'll hear the latest news from the VA, tell you about some area events for Memorial Day, and feature some original content from our veterans. That's Let's Talk Vets, Wednesday, 7 p.m., right here on Radio Catskill, your local resource with a global reach.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricia Robayo. The Sullivan County Democrat has a new addition to their newspaper. Oy & Sullivan is a Spanish language newspaper, and I'm sitting down virtually with Rebecca Rivera, the editor of the Spanish language newspaper, Oy & Sullivan. She's here to talk about the latest issue of Oy & Sullivan and talk about the matters that are facing the Hispanic community. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Patricio. It's really an honor to be here and talking about the paper, which is really important.
Right. Just full disclosure to the listeners, Rebecca Rivera is also my wife. So just get that out of the way.
Yes, full disclosure.
So like I said, the second issue is out now. What can you tell us about what's in this issue, in this edition of Oy & Sullivan?
Yeah, so our latest issue came out last week. Each issue comes out around the 15th of every month, which is great. And this month, which is our second issue, as you mentioned, we're going to be talking about a lot of things that are facing not only the Hispanic community, but just things that are happening around the county in general. I want to start off with talking about sports. This issue, we're going to be highlighting two sisters, both athletes in the Eldred School District, Lily Gonzalez and Olivia Gonzalez. And so the article is written by our one of the editors at the paper, Joseph Abraham, and it just highlights, you know, who these athletes are and what they've been able to contribute to their teams. So much so that they have, they have a good season and they started off quite well so far. And they've won so far 6 out of their first 7 games, which is a tremendous attribute.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Congratulations to them. Now, this being, you know, the second issue of Oy & Sullivan, with the first issue coming out last month, has there been any sort of growing pains, or have you sort of run into some kind of, or any hurdles in sort of getting this newspaper up and running?
Yeah, so our biggest sort of hurdle thus far has been spreading the word about the paper. It's been spreading since the beginning by word of mouth, but we do want to put it out there that this is a free publication that comes out every month. Right now we have it at certain integral locations throughout Monticello, Liberty, and Fallsburg region of Sullivan County. And primarily they're at the local government center. We're getting them into the libraries. They might be in some businesses that you frequently visit in those three areas of the county. But that's the biggest thing, is spreading the word. We are so grateful for those individuals who have been talking about the paper. We are also very grateful for our contributing writers who've been putting together pieces that focus, again, not just on the Hispanic community, which is the primary focus for the paper, but just to give information to Spanish-speaking individuals around the county.
That's great. It's a much-needed resource because, according to the census that we last that just came out, this has been an increase in the Hispanic population here in Sullivan County. So it's great that now there is an issue, there's a newspaper out there that is in their native language. What's some of the things you look into sort of tackle as the newspaper goes on?
Well, we've been trying to focus on issues, big issues such as COVID. We have an article this week from the county talking about providing readers with a COVID update. We also have another article that addresses the new laws that were changed earlier this year regarding absentee voting, which is a big thing that really does impact our community, whether it be small town elections or even larger nationwide elections. So that's I think those are two really important things, because again, it's really difficult to spread the word out in sort of our native English language. It's much harder to do so when you are trying to reach out Spanish-speaking individuals. We also have a piece by Luis Alvarez that really focuses on the office of the sheriff. In his piece, he talks about sort of commonly asked questions regarding immigration and rights, what to do in case you want to, you know, if you need help or assistance, what are some of the questions that he has heard in his experience working with the local sheriff department? So I think those are really big things. We have other stories that are in the works for the next issue. We're looking at covering stories that deal with the baby formula shortage, abortion issues, which is a really hot button topic, not just in our county, but across the country as well. So those are things that are coming up. And we also have some other really important stories that are in the works as well.
Right. And those individuals who can't find the paper, you can always check it out online at scdemocratonline.com. We last spoke to the managing editor for the Democrat on the program, the local edition, and when the first issue came out. And since then, you know, you're talking about the word getting out. I noticed that you guys now have a Instagram page, you have a Facebook page. So can you talk about that, sort of doing the outreach digitally and sort of exploring this new world, or not new world, but the new world of social media?
Yeah, it's really important because it is sort of it's a good market for advertising. And again, it allows us to spread the word. We're just not relying on individuals talking about it when they're in the line at the supermarket, but, you know, following us on Facebook. And it's a slow process starting up, but please stay tuned. You know, we are looking to add more content to our social media platforms to kind of draw in readers and let people know what's on the pages of Hoy and Sullivan.
Now, the newspaper, is it a mix of stories that are published already in the Democrat, or are these also just exclusive stories, or sort of a 50-50 mix of it? What is it exactly, the Hoy and Sullivan?
Yeah, so right now we're looking at maybe a 60-40 split. 60% of the articles in Hoy and Sullivan are translated pieces that originally appeared in the Sullivan County Democrats. We call that our briefs section. And in this month's issue, we have some really important articles that deal with the increase in fentanyl usage and the opioid crisis. We also have a piece that you wrote, Patricio, that talks about the repairs that are going on in the town of Fallsburg regarding the upgrade to the sewer plant. So we really do want to inform our readers who might be familiar with the Sullivan Democrats and allow opportunities for individuals who don't read English or don't understand English to also read the same information that they would if they did read in another language. So we hope to grow that, meaning creating sort of standalone pieces that only appear in Hoy and Sullivan. But I kind of like the blend of actually having things that have appeared in the Sullivan Democrat also appearing in Hoy and Sullivan and vice versa. I think it's a good balance. And I know it's going to take a couple of issues to really create that relationship even more tighter and easier for people to follow along.
Right, definitely. Because, you know, the issues that are the articles that are coming out in Sullivan County Democrat affects everyone. You know, everything from the school board budgets to taxes to like the sewer district in Fallsburg. Could be a population out there that could miss out on the information and affects them directly. It affects them in their tax levy, or it could affect them in their water levy. You say that, you know, the newspaper is out and you guys are focusing, the newspaper should say is focusing on these three locations in Sullivan County. I guess your basis, your thought process behind that is because these are the three areas in Sullivan County that are mostly populated, or should have a high percentage of the Hispanic population. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. And so that's our target audience, although our goal, I think our long-term goal is to to cover all areas and to have people who don't live in those three parts of Sullivan County have access to Oyen Sullivan. Although, as you mentioned earlier, anyone can read up on what's happening in Oyen Sullivan just by going to the Sullivan County Democrats website. It is there posted every month for free. It's a free PDF download. But our goal is to reach out as much as possible. One of the things that really motivated me to take on this project was the idea that we are sort of reaching out to individuals that probably sort of get lost in the mix. And I think it's quite easy to do if you don't understand the language. And I really do want to cover what they're doing, what Spanish speaking communities are doing in Sullivan County, because we do have a tremendous population of individuals and they own businesses. They work in schools. They work in local government. They really help to provide social and other important services to individuals living in the county. And I just want to make sure that they're being represented adequately in the language that they feel most comfortable with.
Right, right. Well said. Like I said, it's a growing population. And just with personal experience and knowing that how these some people in the Hispanic community feel more comfortable when they're spoken to in their native language, you know, just information at doctors or even just visiting the government center or anything like that.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, you asked earlier, what's the hurdle? That's another hurdle as well. Most communities are very sort of, you know, they keep themselves within the confines of their own cultural communities, which is understandable. And so we're working with other organizations and using them as ways to reach out to larger populations and say, hey, here's a newspaper that gives you information. You know, here's something you may not have read about in other places. This is what might directly or indirectly be impacting you. And it's important for you to know. So again, we really could not get this up and running without those organizations or individuals that are really helping to push our paper forward. Well, one of the things that I do want to encourage listeners is that if there is something that's happening in your community, not necessarily in Liberty, Monticello, or Fallsburg, but that you feel is important for a Spanish-speaking population or residents, you know, please do contact the paper. We are looking for stories. We are looking for sort of things that everyone should be aware of. You can contact me directly at rrivera@sc-democrat.com. And we can definitely, talk about what's happening. And we are a growing paper. And my goal is, and I'm sure that Joseph has a similar thought in mind, who is a managing editor, is to really have a larger sort of informative and helpful resource for community members.
That's great. I said the issues, the May issue came out last week and it could be found on scdemocratonline.com. The June issue is being worked on. And I, you know, you mentioned before some other people are contributing to it and I say watching the paper grow. Before we leave, Rebecca, is there anything that we have not touched on that you want our listeners to know about Oyen Sullivan or just in general about some of the issues that are facing the Hispanic community?
That's a really heavy question. But, you know, just know that we're trying to give a voice to a population of Sullivan County, which is so important. Everyone deserves to be heard. And, you know, we are on the side of everybody in Sullivan County. And as a Hispanic myself, I just want to make sure that we are a well-informed community to make the best decisions for ourselves and our loved ones.
That's great. Great. Thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca. We were talking to Rebecca Rivera, the editor for Oyen Sullivan, the first Spanish language newspaper in Sullivan County that's published by the Sullivan County Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us. And we hope to have you back at the program soon.
Thank you so much, Patricio.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Remember, you can hear this episode and previous episodes on our website, wjffradio.org. And while you're there, check out our podcast. I'm Patricio Rubio. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Radio Catskill. Public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Listen local.
I'm Aaron Bendich. Join me for Borscht Beat, the Jewish music show on Radio Catskill. Each week I share rare, forgotten, and classic recordings from Jewish musical traditions across multiple generations, from Yiddish folk songs to instrumental klezmer, Yiddish theater, and contemporary performances. It's a grand tour of many musical landscapes. That's Borscht Beat, an hour of Jewish music in the Catskills, Sunday afternoons at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
Support for Farm and Country comes from
Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org. This is Rosie Starr for Radio Catskill. Welcome to Farm and Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show, Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report describes the naming conventions for several planets and moons. Christine San Jose frolics along the Poets Row in the month of May. I stop by Wild Yarrow Farm in Coshecton, New York, to pick up my trio of thyme herbs and say hello to Jeffrey Rose. I visit the Agriculture Day in May.